Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. How do you sleep? Most people say they want to get better rest. We visit with a sleep expert to get some tips. Many pollinators are getting ready for the cold winter by going underground. We'll visit one nature preserve to learn more. Also, a lack of rain this year is adding to farmers' costs, and we hear how one town dealt with a water emergency this summer. The landmark legislation ending cash bail in Illinois has proven controversial. We'll hear about the effects in one central Illinois county. We'll also visit with the mayor of an Illinois community where an ice processing facility is located. And we'll get a preview of a museum's exhibit focused on Tiffany glassware. That and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. You might associate bees with lush summer gardens and meadows. But this fall, one northern Illinois prairie is abuzz with the pollinators preparing to head underground for the winter. Jess Savage visited Nachusa Grasslands in Lee County to understand the special habitat.
Fall is here at Nachusa Grasslands in Franklin Grove. Despite the warmer-than-normal temperatures, the dry rustling of tall grasses and prairie plants signal to visitors like me that peak summer flower season is winding down. But there are still a few key late-season flowers offering a pollen treat to native bees in this 4,000-acre prairie. Warm yellow goldenrod and bright purple and white clusters of heath aster make for an excellent pollination opportunity.
So you can see it's already, the flowers have kind of faded, but it hasn't quite gone to seed yet. So, you know, maybe last week or 2 weeks ago, the bees would have been all over that one. And now this week, the heath aster is blooming. The bees are all over the heath aster.
That's Elizabeth Bach, an ecosystem restoration scientist at the preserve. While a healthy ecosystem has a wide variety of plant species, they also need to bloom at different times of the year. Bach refers to this as temporal diversity.
There's this sense of temporal diversity as much as there is the spatial diversity. When we're doing restorations at a place like Nachusa Grasslands, we're thinking about that kind of having food during the whole year.
Nachusa Grasslands is a remnant prairie, which means most parts of it have never been plowed or used for agriculture. That's because its sandy soils weren't quite conducive to productive crops. Bach says she loves that prairie ecosystems are, in her words, subtle.
The more you get to know them, the more you love them, I think. I love that they're so intricate. There's so many parts coming together.
This place is one of those rare instances in Illinois where visitors can look to every horizon and see only prairie landscape. It's home to nearly 280 native bee species. That's more than half of the species you'll find in this region. It's also home to about 100 bison. They were reintroduced a decade ago and have shaped the prairie into what it is today. Bach notes that prairies and humans have evolved side by side. Indigenous peoples manage prairies through controlled burns, and grazing bison keep the landscape managed as well.
You can't take humans out of prairies. The prairies won't thrive that way. And so I've increasingly learned to respect that role and understand that relationship. That being said, humans have very limited control.
Prairies are a complex system of relationships and interactions. That brings us back to the bees. One of the best examples, bison like to roll on the ground and scratch their sides and back. This creates bare patches of ground called wallows, perfect for solitary native bees to start excavating and creating their winter burrows this time of year. They dig out their singular tunnel using their legs and mouth parts. In late September, Bach said these wallows were literally humming with activity. The remnant prairie is a research site as well. Dr. Bethan Berninga Sokolar has been studying pollinator populations at Nachusa for a decade. She's curious about the mechanics of bee decision-making in a habitat like this.
I've been quite interested in trying to understand, at a very small scale, you know, how do bees make those kind of individual level decisions about how they're foraging and what those implications might be for plant reproduction.
Nachusa is special because it's so large and has such a variety of plants. Berninga Sokolar's research shows this quality makes for an especially diverse variety of bee species at the preserve.
There's a lot of things that make Nachusa really special, but from the bee community standpoint, just the fact that it is large and is able to encapsulate several different habitat types is what gives us the high diversity that we have.
Even though it's a pretty quiet afternoon in the prairie, the pollinators are busy. One bright green bee wiggles its way into a tiny hole in the bison wallow. Till next spring, I'm Jess Savage in Franklin Grove.
U.S. farmers are facing rising costs. That includes fertilizer, a critical part of getting high yields. Millions of tons of the product travel up the Mississippi River each year. Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval reports on how low rainfall could contribute to even higher fertilizer prices.
The Mississippi River, stretching over 2,000 miles, is essential for farmers to sell their crops. Nearly half of all U.S. corn, soybeans, and wheat exports pass through here on their way to the Gulf of Mexico. I'm standing at the edge of the river on the pier in Red Wing, Minnesota, just south of the Twin Cities. This is the furthest point where barges can travel into the U.S. to pick up their crops for export. It's also the last stop for them to unload fertilizers, herbicides, and other essential inputs farmers need. Here, water is plentiful, and barges glide easily along. But in the lower half of the Mississippi, south of Illinois, there's been little rain. Some parts of the river could drop by 8 feet in weeks. Captain Mike Knapper, a Mississippi River tug and pull pilot, says barges have to carry lighter loads to avoid scraping the bottom of the ship's hull on the riverbed.
You know, the less product you take, they got to make more trips to get, you know, X amount of products from A to B.
He now operates out of a pier in Wisconsin, but previously worked in Memphis, Tennessee for 7 years. By late September, the Farm Bureau reported that barge rates had already risen significantly above their long-term averages. If the river shrinks as forecasted for October, rates could reach previous drought year highs.
Somebody else has got to pay the piper for that extra trip. Well, then on the flip side of that, the fertilizer companies are going to charge the farmer more. And trust me, I spent the first 18 years of my life on a dairy farm. I know all about that.
Paul Freeman's farm in Starbuck, Minnesota, is a couple of hours away from the river's edge. The combine we're in is inhaling rows of soybeans. He's feeling the pressure from the fertilizer spikes and expects next spring to be no different.
They're going to spread that cost down the line to where the person has to pay it. That's me.
But he's got a plan. He'll buy his fertilizer earlier this year in the winter to better plan his costs for the spring.
Has that happened before?
Farmers are getting smarter and they're doing that more.
Chad Hart, an ag economist at Iowa State University, agrees. He says that while some buy fertilizer early, others wait, hoping that the price will come down.
You're just trying to figure out best how to time the market to try to avoid those pinch points.
These rising costs come at a time when many producers are already in a tough place. China has decided not to buy any soybeans for the upcoming market year. It's also buying less corn.
So it's sort of a double whammy. For farmers here. They're facing lower prices for their corn and soybeans if we can't move as fast down the river. But we're also facing higher fertilizer, higher input costs because of that same problem.
Back at his farm, Paul Freeman is about to unload today's harvest into a storage truck. It's usually a moment of great pride, but with high operating costs and low revenues, his margins are tightening.
At the end of the day, I got to make ends meet, just like the person that I have to do in the checkout at the grocery store, that person has to make ends meet also.
So he's adapting. He's expanding his local business connections, selling specialty crops to Japan, and putting less fertilizer on his fields. I'm Tadeo Ruiz Sandoval, Harvest Public Media.
A new exhibit is putting the spotlight on Tiffany lamps. Beyond the Shade is now on display at the Driehaus Museum in Chicago. The exhibit examines the range of material and design used in light fixtures by Tiffany & Company. Alexandra Ruggiero with the museum spoke with Gary Zydek.
I think a good starting point is probably to talk about the namesake. People hear Tiffany and they likely think about either the famous jewelry store or these legendary lamps. And there is a connection between these two things. Louis Tiffany is the son of Charles Tiffany, the founder of the Tiffany & Company jewelry empire.
Louis C. Tiffany was, as
you just said, he was the son of the luxury good retailer Tiffany & Company, the son of Charles Louis Tiffany. And we think of Tiffany & Company today as just a jewelry store, but when it was first founded, it was an import store. So it brought in decorative arts from, you know, international decorative arts to New York City. So growing up, Tiffany, the son, Louis C. Tiffany, was really exposed to all of these decorative arts, and he would go on to form his own company as he was kind of entered the field of American interior decoration right when it was just starting. And he became someone who was completing these elaborate interiors, like in Chicago. You know, I think immediately of the Chicago Cultural Center, which was, you know, the Chicago Public Library previously, with that gorgeous Tiffany interior. So Tiffany started off that way and then eventually kind of created these companies like Tiffany Studios, which would go on to produce what we think of as like the famous leaded glass Tiffany lampshade.
For those of us that know the name but don't know much else, what is it about Tiffany's stained glass that separated itself from other makers of that time?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things we really wanted to explore in this exhibition. You know, we titled it Beyond the Shade because I think that most people, and myself included, when you hear the phrase Tiffany lamp, the first thing that kind of pops to mind are those lampshades that are made of all of those different types of, you know, colorful glass, carefully assembled together. But that was really just one style of lighting that Tiffany produced through Tiffany Studios. She was making everything from really delicate, like small table lamps to these monumental chandeliers, imposing floor lamps, and everything from oil and gas and electric. So the exhibition focuses kind of on the breadth of that production and then also contextualizes a little bit what made the Tiffany shade so popular and why it has such an enduring legacy. You know, no one else was producing that type of a lampshade when it first debuted. When Tiffany first, you know, produced these shades, they were revolutionary. No one had seen them before. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that Tiffany Studios was a really clever business. So the firm actually held a patent for the technique used to make those lampshades. And so by the time the patent expired, it had already become kind of synonymous with the Tiffany name. So even though other companies tried to jump into the market and produce similar ones, they were already known as Tiffany lamps, and they, because Tiffany was using all of these really outstanding materials and had this high level of craftsmanship, they really were just kind of above any of those competitions.
How would you describe Tiffany's ideas regarding form and function?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tiffany was just such an artistic kind of soul. He was such an artistic person. And, you know, the objects he was producing through Tiffany Studios were definitely functional items. Like, you think about the lamps, you know, I feel like one of the reasons why they remain so popular is they're so usable today. But I think he also approached all of these works as kind of unique works of art, and they really were sculptures. I mean, a lot of the lamps that are on view in the exhibition, or lamps that Tiffany produced in general, were illuminated sculptures and are these amazing pieces of art in their own right. One of the things I think that's really special about this exhibition being at the Driehaus Museum is that often in a museum setting, we see these works by themselves, you know, kind of on the pedestal, surrounded by other potentially period pieces. But at the Driehaus, you're seeing them installed in a period space. And there's a great conversation that happens between those lamps and the surrounding floors and wall and ceiling with all of this mix of materials. It's a really kind of unique space to see these works in. And we were commenting recently when we walked through how they kind of feel all at home in a way that feels really special.
If you're just tuning in, my name is Gary Zydek. I'm talking with Alexandra Ruggiero, the curator of the Driehaus Museum's new exhibit, Tiffany Lamps, Beyond the Shade. What was your approach to curating the exhibit? These are all pieces from the private collection of the late Richard Driehaus.
The works in the exhibition primarily come from the museum's collection and then the private collection of Mr. Driehaus. And the reason why I think this exhibition kind of came about, how I think about the spark that started Tiffany Lamps Beyond the Shade, is that when I was invited to curate this exhibition and I came on, I started looking at all of the different objects in the collection, and it became very apparent that what Mr. Driehaus was collecting really was so varied. You know, some collectors, when they're looking at Tiffany Lamps, are trying to create a collection that's like every type of leaded shade that there was, or every type of this particular type. But I think what guided Mr. Driehaus was collecting was more things that he was drawn to. And so what that created was a collection that has everything from table lamps to desk lamps to chandeliers. And it made me think about this catalog that Tiffany Studios had published, in which they talk about how the stock of the studios is so varied and contains all of these different types of lighting fixtures. So it was this kind of exciting aha moment where I realized that this group of objects, these collections, would enable an exhibition that really showcased the full kind of production of Tiffany Studios lighting fixtures.
Once you got in the space, the Driehaus Museum space, did you have specific ideas about how you wanted to display the lamps?
We did. We had a lot of conversations, the entire Driehaus team, leading up to, you know, creating this exhibition, even leading up to working with our great exhibition designer, about how we wanted the display to feel different than some of the past Tiffany exhibitions, and that we wanted to use it as an opportunity to also push the display beyond the traditional pedestal. So, you know, when you go through the exhibition and you see all these objects grouped together on these platforms, these pedestals of varying heights, we really wanted to create a display that would now allow light to kind of come off from the wall, to have depth and variation and different heights, like with the hanging chandeliers. So we really thought through how can we make sure that we're, you know, showing this range of production, but also showing it in a way where we can group objects together and have them have conversations with each other and then conversations with the space around them.
That's the Driehaus Museum in Chicago's Alexandra Ruggiero. She spoke with Gary Zydek about Tiffany Lamps Beyond the Shade as an exhibit on display until next spring. We'll look at how the end of cash bail is working in one Illinois county. That's ahead on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. 2 years after landmark criminal justice reform removed cash bail in Illinois, advocates celebrated the end of a pay-to-play system that kept people in jail simply for a lack of money. Critics said cashless bail would lead to more crime and more missed court dates. As with most things, the truth lies somewhere in the middle. Eric Stock talked with reporter Lauren Warnicki in Bloomington Normal. She's been following the end of cash bail and the specific effects in McLean County.
So give us the broad strokes. What do we know about the impact of eliminating cash bail in Illinois?
The Pretrial Fairness Act, or the PFA, had the potential to impact courts and jails the most. And McLean County Jail saw a steep drop-off in occupancy right at the start of the PFA in September 2023. Sheriff Matt Lane recently told WGLT occupancy was around the 150s per day in late 2023. And since then, the population has kind of steadily crept back up and now actually exceeds pre-PFA levels. Sheriff Lane says they're now hovering around 230 to 240 beds filled on any given day.
So wait a minute now. Advocates had said that the end of cash bail was going to reduce the jail population. Now it's going up. Has crime gotten worse, or why?
Yeah, not necessarily related to crime. Frank Beck is a sociologist with Illinois State University's Stevenson Center, which tracks trends in the McLean County justice system. Despite some saying crime rates would balloon under cashless bail, he says,
there is no indication of that. I mean, as far as I know, the number of bookings on new charges has not increased.
But Beck says his data shows arrest warrants are up, and that's in large part due to defendants who violate the terms of their pretrial release.
I don't think that's an increase in crime. I think that that is persons who were not detained, who were released. They were given a notice to appear, court dates and they miss the court date, and then there's a warrant for their arrests.
Now, what's the reaction from law enforcement to this?
Sheriff Lane agrees with everything Frank Beck is saying, saying much of the jail population that's new is there because of a sanction or a pretrial release violation. So people charged with non-detainable offenses then violate the terms of their release and wind up back in jail. Lane says a large proportion of those cases are drug charges.
When there is no bond and they're released immediately on a notice to appear for, say, a drug charge, there's no break in the drug usage, I think is a little bit of the problem. And so they're immediately back to it, and they continue to miss court, whereas if they were held at least for a short amount of time and to see the judge to set a bond and then come up with a bond, that sometimes gives them a break.
And, you know, we can say that the sheriff's probably like partially right here. Data from the office, the statewide office of pretrial services, which manages both pretrial investigations and monitors pretrial release, say since the beginning of the Pretrial Fairness Act in 2023, 94% of all people enrolled in these pretrial release services in McLean County do show up for court. Although that doesn't include necessarily people who are immediately released without a hearing. And this data also does not stratify the information by charge, for example. Sheriff Lane says he thinks judges and prosecutors really deserve more agency in deciding who should and shouldn't stay in jail.
My opinion is that if you have local judges who know their community and know the issues, and you take decisions out of their hands, that's detrimental to your community. They should have the opportunity to apply their knowledge and their expertise to know when somebody should be held or not.
Now, in previous interviews, McLean County's top prosecutor, State's Attorney Erica Reynolds, agrees with Lane, saying cash bail effectively takes away too much discretion from the courts. Though more often than not, when she filed a petition to have a defendant detained, she wins. The statewide office of pretrial services says that her success rate is around 68%, and Reynolds did decline to comment for this story in particular.
Now, President Trump recently weighed in on cashless bail. He issued an executive order trying to create a blanket federal ban and said the counties that defy the order could risk losing federal funding. So what are officials in McLean County saying about that?
Sheriff Matt Lane says he was not aware of any specific guidance about this order. And remember, the county is just following state law here, so it doesn't really matter what Sheriff Lane's personal opinions are about cashless bail. The sheriff says he doesn't anticipate the order will lead to any changes. McLean County Chief Judge Casey Costigan told WGLT in a statement the court's job is to simply apply the law as written, and cashless bail has been litigated in Illinois and been found to be constitutional. So the judge essentially bows out of any opinion on cash bail, saying it's the job of the legislature to write and modify the law. But he also says, quote, "We would, however, be deeply disappointed by any cuts to federal funding that supports programs designed to assist individuals in need, prevent crime, and reduce recidivism."
Now, is there any way to track which defendants are more likely to violate pretrial release and miss their hearing?
Yeah, again, the answer here is sort of. I said earlier that 6% of court dates among those enrolled in pretrial services were missed. So the critical question is, who is that 6% that's missing court? Sheriff Lane blamed drug charges, since people in active addiction are more likely to show up in court if they're held in jail. When pressed, Sheriff Lane says methamphetamine is the primary problem, and that actually tracks with the data. In the Stevenson Institute data at ISU that tracks McLean County in particular, missed court appearances for drug charges did not significantly change under the Pretrial Fairness Act, despite changes in the legal code about drug charges being able to be detained or not. The exception is meth charges, in which absence from court has increased pretty dramatically.
All right, so what else do we know?
Well, there's another trend that the Stevenson Center is tracking that kind of runs in parallel, though it's not directly related to cashless bail. But it is contributing to this steady increase in the jail population. Frank Beck from ISU notes that half of detainees now have some kind of mental health condition. So that's an increase of more than 20% over the last decade. And it does not include substance use disorders related to drugs or alcohol, though those often occur together.
So what is the reason for that change?
So again, there's not simply one cause to the change. It could be because there's more awareness and better reporting of mental health conditions, both through a combination of self-reporting and symptoms or behavioral concerns noticed by police at booking or guards at the jail. But Frank Beck from the Stevenson Center says the central issue is actually systemic.
There's a fundamental problem with persons who have a mental health issue, who are in the jail, who are set to be sent to a state facility for their own, you know, that's how it's adjudicated, and that's how it's, for their benefit. There's no beds. And so they're staying in McLean County longer because the state can't take them.
This is something that Sheriff Lane has corroborated.
Lauren, thank you for your reporting.
It's my pleasure.
That's Lauren Warnicki reporting on the end of cash bail in Illinois. It's been 2 years since that law took effect. Katrina Thompson was elected mayor of the small village of Broadview near Chicago in 2017. She's now in the national spotlight. Her town is home to an ICE processing facility that's been ground zero for violent clashes between federal agents and protesters and visits from top Trump administration officials. Mariah Wolfel has more details.
Mayor Katrina Thompson tries to keep her mind right by starting her day at 4 a.m. with silent meditation and prayer. But lately, the more intense days end a lot louder, with Thompson belting out an Ice Cube diss track on her car ride home.
It just charged me up, like when the attacks come, and I know I don't deserve that.
She says it's a stress reliever at the end of long days that have included sparring with the Trump administration. To quash protests, ICE has used tear gas that residents say lingers for hours, and pepper balls that have struck journalists. Thompson's chief of police says he himself has been verbally accosted by federal agents, and neighbors have complained of disruptive protests going late into the evening. But spending time with me outside a coffee shop and then in her office, Thompson comes off as unflappable in the face of it all.
I got to stay focused on what keep people safe. This is my community. The residents, our business stakeholders, all of the visitors that come in and out of our town, we're responsible for them.
In some key ways, the 55-year-old California native was built for this moment. She was raised by a single mom in Inglewood, California, who taught her to be fiercely self-assured, and by grandparents who grew up in the 1930s American South. Together, they taught Thompson and her now late sister about resiliency and Black history. The strong sense of Black identity is what's driving her in this moment.
We've been here before, and what has changed? Now it's just immigrants. But prior to this, it was Black people.
Broadview is majority Black, firmly working class, and deeply blue. Residents voted roughly 88% for former Vice President Kamala Harris in the 2024 presidential election. On a recent weekday evening, a neighbor named Georgia had her front door open to let the breeze in. She's lived here for 30 years.
It's a family-oriented community, quiet, just like what you hear now. This is what you hear all the time.
Georgia, who didn't share her last name, says she is glad to see Thompson speaking out against what she sees as aggressive and violent action by the feds. But some residents told WBEZ and the Sun-Times they want Thompson to do more for residents, like institute a curfew on protests to protect the elderly from disruptions. On Monday, Thompson did just that. She signed an executive order that says protests must end by 6 p.m. It's not clear how that would work or even if it would be legal, but it's an indication of how Thompson is trying to navigate this moment, putting her residents first while also attempting to support protesters. State Representative LaShawn Ford has been friends with Thompson for 15 years.
Her focus has always been on the residents of Broadview, and I've never heard her step into an arena of wanting to do anything else.
As Thompson continues to find her footing on the bigger stage that she didn't ask to be on, her actions will be closely watched and critiqued. But the faithful Baptist says she's gotten signs of encouragement from her guardian angels. The other day when she was driving, she heard the voice of her grandmother.
My grandmother was just like, just stand, don't take no from nobody.
Thompson says she's trying to heed that advice. Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ News.
Well, the former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan is now officially a federal prison inmate, he reported this week. Dave McKinney has details.
The longest-serving House Speaker in American history checked into a minimum-security federal prison camp in Morgantown, West Virginia. That's where he'll serve a 7.5-year sentence for bribery, conspiracy, wire fraud, and other crimes. Morgantown is an all-male facility housing about 180 inmates just south of Pittsburgh. It's also about 500 miles from Chicago, farther than a Terre Haute, Indiana prison camp where the 83-year-old Madigan wanted to go. Earlier this year, a federal jury convicted him of helping ComEd legislatively in exchange for the company giving his political operatives no-work contracts. The jury also convicted Madigan of trading favors with a government mole to win business for his law firm.
For a total of 8 days in July, residents of the east central Illinois town of Mattoon were told not to use their tap water. Harmful algal blooms in city reservoirs produced dangerous toxins that made the water unsafe for drinking, cooking, bathing, even dishwashing. The problem threatens water systems in other parts of the country as well. Jim Meadows reports.
An annual festival in Mattoon that circles around bagels was a little different this year. There was still live music and plenty of carnival rides, as well as bagels, of course, provided by a local commercial bakery. But this year, the water had to be trucked in. Food vendor Chris Walton says it didn't help that city officials went back and forth on a do not drink order.
As a matter of fact, some of our machines have all been sanitized, and then, of course, they put the order back in. So everything we did was for naught now. So we're going to have to re-sanitize everything, you know, that we're not using right now.
Elsewhere in Mattoon, the do not drink order forced restaurants to close or make do with paper plates and bottled water. Algal blooms in the city's two reservoirs had sent toxins into the tap water. Bacteria in the blooms produced dangerous levels of microcystins, a neurotoxin that can sicken and even kill people who drink, cook, or wash with it. Robert Hirschfeld is director of water policy with the Illinois-based environmental group Prairie Rivers Network. He says nitrogen and phosphorus runoff from farms are often behind the blooms.
I wouldn't say that there were no harmful algal blooms 100 years ago, but as we've tracked them, the frequency and severity has increased in recent years.
In 2023, Guthrie, Oklahoma had to switch its water source after an algal bloom affected one of its reservoirs. A massive bloom in Lake Erie left residents of Toledo, Ohio, unable to use their water for days in 2014. Environmental scientist Gregory Dick, who studies algal blooms at the University of Michigan, says the toxins from such blooms make water unusable.
That affects not just people's drinking water, but their ability to take medicines, their ability to shower, their ability to cook. So it really disrupted lives for residents, for businesses, for hospitals.
Toledo installed expensive sensors and carbon filtration to help make sure its water supply is clean. Such solutions will likely be needed in more towns and cities throughout the Midwest, Dick says, as algal blooms don't appear to be slowing down. But Keith Lofton, who studies algal blooms at the U.S. Geological Survey's Kansas Water Science Center, says it's difficult to know if the blooms have actually gotten worse.
Many claim that blooms are becoming more frequent, greater in magnitude, duration, and spatial extent. However, largely we lack robust, consistently collected data sets throughout modern times to make large, sweeping national and global statements.
Back in Mattoon, the city council voted this summer to spend roughly $300,000 to buy a new reservoir water pump and spray algicide to control the algal blooms. City manager Kyle Gill says eventually they'll need to dredge their reservoirs to get rid of fertilizer-embedded silt.
We'll spend hundreds of thousands of dollars in the short term, but most of the long-term solutions are millions of dollars.
At the moment, Mattoon's water supply is okay. But after a new algal bloom appeared in Lake Mattoon in August, that reservoir's beach was closed for much of the month. I'm Jim Meadows, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. Still ahead, we'll talk about getting a good night's sleep. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Not sleeping well, many people say they get poor sleep. It can leave you sluggish, cranky, and prone to health problems. Sasha Ann Simons talked with a sleep expert in this segment.
All right, how did I sleep last night? Why, thank you for asking. Last night was okay. I mean, just okay. I got about 5 hours of sleep in, which is up from my usual 3.5 or 4 hours. And I know I'm not alone. So check on your friends and your coworkers and your family, because more than half of American adults are dragging themselves through the day after a bad night's sleep. They're not getting the rest that they need. And it's not just about feeling cranky or unfocused. Long-term sleep deprivation is tied to serious health issues, from heart disease and weight gain to depression. So, what exactly is keeping us up at night, and how can we set ourselves up for better rest? Our next guest might just have the answers. At the table, Dr. Sabra Abbott, who is a neurologist at Northwestern Medicine in the Center for Circadian and Sleep Medicine. Welcome to In the Loop.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to see you. So I talked a little bit there about my terrible sleep patterns. It's rough. It's rough, Doc, and I'm really glad that you're here. I swear this is not just about me, though. You know, as I described, this is impacting many, many people. But in my case, I think I typically fall asleep. I've got it down to a science now. I typically fall asleep right around 10, 10:30, not for lack of trying to fall asleep earlier. And like clockwork, I get up at 2. Mm-hmm. And then again at 3:19, very specific. And then I'll finally open my eyes again at about 4:12. Mm-hmm. And then that's it. We're done.
Yeah.
So at what point do you think I should be worried about having too many of those in a row?
So I think the first thing to think about is, how do you feel during the day?
Okay, I think I'm good getting through this stretch, right? We're on live radio right now at 9 in the morning, and I'm surprisingly fine. And my senior producer, Meha, is reminding me that I do this without coffee, Dr.
Ooh,
Abbott.
Impressive.
I am not a coffee drinker. And so I'm doing this without coffee. I'm fine. I feel fine. But by the time Say More is over at 11, I'm starting to crash. You know, I'm up just enough to listen to Mary and Pat, and then I'm like, okay, let's find a quiet room so that we can nap, maybe.
Yeah. So the first thing when we're trying to define somebody as having a bad night of sleep, the first thing to think about is it actually impacting how you're functioning during the day, or are you just somebody who's a little bit of a lighter sleeper? Is your sleep a little more fragmented? Not that we're talking about personal advice, but you did say something right up front that kind of caught my ear, which is not without lack of trying.
Oh, I try. I try. I get in that bed at 9 and I'm like, all right, here we go.
And that is the first thing that can start to lead people to having insomnia, because the more you turn it into a job and work at trying to sleep better, the harder it's going to be.
Oh, so I'm trying too hard.
Yes.
So, okay, so what do I do then? I just stay up and keep the TV on and just like let it naturally happen? Is that what you're saying?
So one of the first strategies that we have when we're trying to help people sleep better is to really focus on the bed and the bedroom as being a place for sleep only. So you really want to figure out how many hours of sleep you're actually getting, and you don't even spend any time in the bedroom outside of that window of time.
Ah, okay.
Because the more time that you spend in bed working on sleep, trying to make it happen, the less likely it's going to happen. So you have to create a window and an opportunity. But if it's not going to happen, get out of the bedroom.
And so take us back a little bit and tell us more about some of the causes of bad sleep. Why does that happen anyway?
Yeah, so there's a lot of easy stuff up front. And so typically people, by the time they come into my office, they're like, I've tried all the sleep hygiene stuff. And so what they mean by that is they're trying to stay off their phone before bedtime. They're trying to avoid caffeine late in the daytime. They're, you know, trying to do the things that you read on the internet.
Alcohol.
Yeah, no alcohol before bedtime. Kind of the usual stuff. Nothing really invigorating and stimulating. Don't start thinking about vaccines and crime and all the other stuff you're talking about right now,
yes,
right before bed. But once you get past that point, typically what we find is sort of everybody who suffers from difficulty sleeping, typically there's some sort of biological predisposition. So maybe other people in your family tend to have more trouble with sleep than the average person.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a thing.
And then on top of that, you may have a bad night of sleep here or there. So it kind of starts the whole process. And then you start thinking, well, last night was bad. I felt crummy in the afternoon. Now tonight is probably going to be worse. And so then you start, even before you're getting into bed, you start thinking about the fact that you're going to have a bad night's sleep. So you already have that anticipation that things are going to go bad. You prepare and you start doing things like spending more time in bed, trying to make sleep happen when it's not going to.
Man, are you watching me throughout the day? Because you are describing my life, Dr. Abbott.
Yes. So, you know, you're not unique in this. There are a lot of people that have these same problems. And so it's just sort of a process that then kind of perpetuates itself over time.
I see. And walk us through some of the types of sleep disorders.
Yeah, so aside from insomnia, there are lots of other things that can also disrupt your sleep. Probably the next most common thing is sleep apnea. And I think especially as a woman, it's really important to keep in mind, we don't always present with sleep apnea in the same way.
So, I forgot to mention, I do have sleep apnea.
Okay.
Mild.
Okay.
Does that affect anything I already told you?
A little bit. So oftentimes for women, the symptom of insomnia may actually be a sign that you have sleep apnea. So if you hadn't already been tested for it and hadn't already looked for it, sometimes it's those apneas, those times where you stop breathing, that wake you up and then your brain turns on and keeps going. And so I think that's probably the second most common thing to keep an eye out for. And another thing to keep in mind, as women, as we're getting older, with hormonal changes, your risk for sleep apnea changes, your risk for insomnia changes. So all of those things can play into it as well.
Yeah. Hey, if you just got here, welcome. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and we are talking about sleep. Hopefully not putting you to sleep. Instead, we are here sharing tips on how to get a better night's rest at a time when it feels like so many of us are not getting enough sleep. And our guest in studio is Dr. Sabra Abbott, who is with Northwestern Medicine. And so let's talk about fixing this, Dr. Abbott. I know that cognitive behavioral therapy can be an alternative to medicine for sleep disorders. How does that work exactly?
Yeah, so basically the idea behind cognitive behavioral therapy, we just talked about all of those factors that are going into your mind already as you're trying to get into the bedroom and attempting to sleep.
Right.
Cognitive behavioral therapy is using behavioral strategies and cognitive restructuring to change all of those associations that you have. You can think about it as, you know, subconsciously you may have conditioned your brain to think of the bedroom as a place where you struggle with sleep, you can't sleep. And so we already talked about a few of the strategies of really limiting that window of time that you're even in the bedroom and allowing yourself to sleep.
Right.
Not staying in the bedroom if you can't sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other strategies. So if you start to go on that mental loop of, oh, I'm not going to sleep well tonight, tomorrow is going to be horrible, I'm not going to be able to do my job, strategies that you can implement to try to improve that. So that's cognitive behavioral therapy is a large toolbox of various things that you can implement.
So when someone comes to see you, what are some of the what's some of the advice that you give? Obviously, you sort of walk through the various scenarios and get to know them better as far as their patterns and their habits. But what do you find yourself kind of going to a lot with folks?
Yeah, so definitely cognitive behavioral therapy. It's the American Academy of Sleep Medicine recommends it as first line. But sort of outside of that, like you said, I really do try to get to know my patients, figure out not just what's going on at night. So much of fixing sleep at night is fixing the daytime. So whether it's that you're doing a lot of stressful activity right up until bedtime, whether you're spending your entire day in a dark, windowless office, whether you're getting physical activity or not, all of these things can also play into sleeping well. So kind of figuring out what factors we can improve on to make your sleep better.
Yeah. And how many of these folks coming to you are still sort of feeling the remnants of the pandemic? Or just what's happening right now, right? I can't even really lean on just pandemic talk anymore because there's just so much happening. And are people just stressed out about just the facts of life right now in the U.S.?
Absolutely. We saw a huge boom in insomnia right around the time of the pandemic because it was just, you know, an upheaval to everything that you were doing in your life, a lot of stressors. I know we were supposed to have a psychologist joining us today, and I think
we could not get a psychologist.
They are not free right now. Our psychologist and social worker are both booked out 6 months to a year right now because
it
is so hard to get in to see somebody. But you're right. We've just had kind of one hit after another of things that keep you up at night, and the news cycle is 24/7. So if you just happen to get that news alert here or there, there's another thing that sort of turns your brain on and makes it hard to fall asleep again.
Absolutely. And so much time for a lot of people is spent at home because of, you know, working from home, right? So there's a lot of increased screen time, and just I wonder how much that has impacted sleep as well.
So certainly screen time does play some role. So we do know that light exposure before bedtime can suppress your production of a hormone called melatonin. So this is something we naturally produce that helps put us in a state that's more permissive for sleep. So that bright light exposure right before bedtime can be problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other problem with a lot of people working from home and being at home is that you may not be outdoors as much. And we do know that light exposure, so getting out, getting sunshine, getting that bright light exposure, does actually help limit the impacts of bright light right before bed.
Oh.
So if you get more bright light during the day, you're less likely to be impacted by a little bit of light right before bedtime.
So there's good to taking walks, taking breaks.
Absolutely.
And taking walks, right? And you take your lunch break outside.
Absolutely.
For instance. You mentioned melatonin. What about the folks who, you know, take that as a way to sort of get right to sleep? Sometimes it works for me, sometimes it doesn't. So I've kind of cooled off of using that. But is that something you prescribe? Or?
I would say your experience is pretty consistent with the data. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
No consistency.
It's not a great, what we call hypnotic, so a sleep aid. It works really well in very specific circumstances. So, for example, if you have jet lag, it does help to reset your internal clock. So taking melatonin around those times can help with resetting.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a subset of patients who are actually, their main issue is timing. So they're extreme night owls. Their natural rhythm doesn't put them to sleep till 3, 4, or 5 in the morning.
Mm.
And we can use melatonin as a time signal to help move that clock earlier.
And as I said earlier, Dr. Abbott, I mean, this is not just because it's like, oh, I'm going to be tired for the rest of the next day. Getting bad sleep can also be really bad for your health, right? It's not just about your productivity when you go to work the next day. What are some of the things that could happen if this persists?
Yeah, so a lot of these studies are association studies at this point. And so whether or not we have direct causality is a little hard to say, but
okay.
We do know, I think one of the largest studies to look at this was the Nurses' Health Study. And so this was following nurses over several years and pulling them on lots of different questions about their health, including their sleep hours, and then looking at whether they developed various conditions. And so we do know that short sleep is associated with risk for weight gain, heart disease, et cetera, all of these things that we don't necessarily want to have long term.
I'm also thinking of the folks who have non-traditional work hours. So maybe
Absolutely.
Their sleep clock is like, you know, 4 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Yeah.
How does this work out for them?
And it's even worse if you add the shift work component to it.
Yes.
And so every single one of those things that I listed is definitely there if you're a shift worker. And add to that, we know that shift work is a probable carcinogen. So it may actually lead to increased risk for cancer.
Goodness. I mentioned napping earlier. What do you think of napping? Does it throw off your clock a little bit, or is it effective? It works for me. I do the power naps in the afternoon and I'm back.
Yeah.
And I don't need a lot of time, just an hour.
And I would maybe even make it shorter than that.
Mm.
So typically, if you're somebody who kind of needs a little bit of sleep just to get through the rest of the day, 30 minutes or shorter is probably something to target.
Okay.
But I also would, if you are actually requiring that nap every single afternoon, I would revisit what's going on with your sleep at night and see
All right.
if maybe it's a sign that you're maybe not getting enough or good quality sleep at night.
All right, Doc. All right, so I'm out of time, but I need a magic number, if there is one. How much sleep do adults need?
This is the question I hate, because there really there really isn't a magic number, and I think if you fixate on that perfect...
Give me a number.
If you fixate on it, that can make your sleep worse. Now, the National Sleep Foundation did release some guidelines, so most adults probably need 7 to 8 hours.
Okay.
But it's a little variable.
7 to 8 hours. You heard it here first from Dr. Sabra Abbott, who's a neurologist at Northwestern University in the Center for Circadian and Sleep Medicine. Thank you so much. Such great tips.
Thanks for having me.
We'll put them to use tonight.
It's time for us to take a rest. We'll be back again next week, though, here on Statewide with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. Find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois public radio stations.